From WBUR in Boston, I'm Karen Given, and this is NPR's Only a Game. March Madness is just around the corner, well, sort of. Ahead on Only a Game, Pat Forty previews the 2009-2010 men's college basketball season. Also, the Blue Jackets assert themselves in territory previously owned exclusively by the Buckeyes, and Indonesian bull racers extend an invitation to President Obama. Also ahead, Chad Ochocinco of the Miami Ochocincos joins me to discuss Ochocinco.
How could you not love me and what I've done for the game as far as having fun and making it exciting? You know, whether you're a fan of the Bengals or not, you know, I'm sure you're a fan of Ocho.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given, in for Bill Littlefield. The madness of March may be months away, but college basketball season is already here. Joining us now to discuss the men's hardwood hopefuls is ESPN.com's Pat Forty. Pat, welcome back to Only a Game.
Karen, happy basketball season to you.
Thank you very much. The North Carolina Tar Heels are the defending national champions. Despite losing star big man Tyler Hansbrough to the NBA, the Heels are still among the early favorites. Do they have enough talent to repeat?
They probably do. Whether it's enough experienced talent is another matter. You know, they've got some very good players. They've got Ed Davis back, who was a very high-impact freshman and played well in the national championship game. Tyler Zeller suffered a broken wrist and didn't play most of last year, but very good player. Marcus Guignard, who missed a lot of last year, also with an injury. So there's a lot of players there, but they're going to have to take on much different roles because they were very used to having Tyler Hansbrough and Ty Lawson and Wayne Ellington do pretty much everything.
North Carolina beat up on Michigan State in last year's title game, but Spartans head coach Tom Izzo has many of his key players back this season. Will Michigan State make another Final Four appearance?
I think they will. You know, I really like this Michigan State team. They did lose a couple of their better players, but they bring back Kalen Lucas, a lot of talented big guys inside, some more athleticism maybe on the wings than Michigan State has had previously. And they're extremely well coached by Tom Izzo. I think getting that taste of the Final Four last year will only help this team. And I look for them to have a big year in what should be a really good Big Ten. That's going to be a fun conference to watch this year.
Duke's last national title came in 2001, and the Blue Devils have been eliminated from the tournament by a lower seed for six straight seasons. Can Coach K lead Duke back to the top?
I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, it's become a disappointing trend if you are a Duke fan. It's, you know, they still put together very good seasons. They have great records. They get high seeds. And then they can't follow through with it in March. And generally, I think what you see is weaknesses that are exposed, whether it's not enough inside strength, whether it's not enough athleticism on the perimeter. But there have been holes in these past several Duke teams, and you know, I think this team's probably in that same mold. You know, it should be a good Duke team, but I don't look for them to be a great Duke team.
Kansas is number one in the Associated Press preseason poll. The Jayhawks are loaded with talent and always tough on defense. How do you like their chances?
Love their chances. They're my preseason number one. They bring back almost everybody from last year with Cole Aldrich, who is a double-double machine at seven-footer, and Sharon Collins, who I think might be the best guard in the country. You know, they bring in a superstar freshman in Xavier Henry, and if he molds in well with the group, that you know they have pretty much everybody back, and they can add him in fairly seamlessly. I think that that's definitely the most talented team, and you combine that with the experience, and I think they're the team to beat.
Ohio State was in the top 20 in most preseason rankings, and the Buckeyes beat James Madison by 28 on Thursday night. How will Ohio State fare this season?
I like Ohio State. Like them a lot. They have a guy, Evan Turner, who had a triple-double in their first game, and I put him on my first-team All-American team. He's already making me look good for that. I appreciate it. He's a really talented guy, 6'7", but can play any one, two, or three, or maybe even four positions on the floor. You know, again, that Big Ten's really, really going to be loaded. I think Purdue's going to be good. Illinois's going to be good. Minnesota, Michigan. But I think Ohio State's right there in the mix with them.
UCLA is a perennial powerhouse, but this year there are more question marks than usual. The Bruins squeaked out a one-point win in an exhibition against Concordia last week. Is this a rebuilding year in L.A.?
No doubt about it. Yeah, I think so. Usually one-point wins over Concordia are not a good sign.
Not good.
No, they're going to struggle. They've lost a lot of good players over the last several years. It is rebuilding mode for them. Ben Howland's a great recruiter. They'll be back, but I wouldn't anticipate them making any sort of Final Four push.
Further up the West Coast, the expectations are high in Washington, where the Huskies are hoping to improve on their second-round exit from the 2009 tournament. Can sophomore Isaiah Thomas, thankfully no relation, take Washington deep this season?
I like the thankfully there. they're very athletic and talented on the perimeter. They've got him. They've got freshman Abdul Gaddy. They've got plenty of talent on the outside. You know, in a watered-down Pac-10, I think Washington and California are probably the two teams to beat in that league.
UConn's shot-blocking machine, Hashim Thabeet, is off to the NBA, but Jim Calhoun still has a strong team. Will last year's recruiting scandal and controversy over Calhoun's state-paid salary have any lingering effects this season?
I think the greater lingering effects will be the talent loss of Thabeet and Jeff Adrian and A.J. Price. And without three guys who are NBA players, you know, that it's going to be a little bit tougher for them. The Big East, you know, probably takes a step back from being maybe the best conference ever last year. So they do have a little bit of a kinder, gentler level of opposition. But still, I think that UConn's probably no more than the third, fourth, or fifth best team in the Big East.
Pat, what other teams should we keep our eyes on?
This year's Cinderella du jour is Butler. Not really a true Cinderella because they've had a lot of success over the years, but coming out of the Horizon League, I think they're ready to challenge the best teams in the country. They're in a lot of preseason top tens. I went ahead and put them in my preseason top five. Everybody is back from last year. They had a couple of guys that were on USA Basketball International teams, got some great experience there. They took a team trip to Italy. And I think that they're ready for a big season. I would not be shocked to see them playing in the Final Four in their home city of Indianapolis.
Wow, big predictions there.
Yeah, you know, probably be wrong, but that's okay. I'll stick my neck out on it.
Pat Forde covers college basketball for ESPN.com and joins us regularly on Only a Game. You can find a link to Pat's latest edition of 40 Minutes at our website, onlyagame.org. Pat, thanks very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Karen.
The Columbus Blue Jackets, losers over their first seven NHL seasons, rewrote the script last year by skating to a 41-31-10 record and earning their first trip to the playoffs. Alas, life in the 2009 postseason proved brutally short for the Blue Jackets, who were swept in the first round by the powerful Detroit Red Wings. But as Only a Game's Ron Schachter reports, Columbus is racking up victories and aiming for the postseason once again.
At a Saturday morning practice in Columbus's Nationwide Arena, Blue Jackets coach Ken Hitchcock shouts at his players over the cacophony. Most observers here agree that the turning point in Blue Jackets history coincided with the arrival of Hitchcock 3 years ago this month. After 10 seasons with Dallas and Philadelphia, he came aboard with a .600 winning percentage, as well as six division titles and the Stanley Cup to his credit. But team captain and leading scorer Rick Nash says it wasn't until the middle of last season that the Blue Jackets and the rest of the league discovered that Columbus could be a winner.
We went on a couple road trips and came back with big wins.
It was kind of a transformation of our team. Teams didn't take us lightly anymore, and it was different. You know, I think we were an easy 2 points for a lot of teams. You know, they were looking at us as an easy game, whether we're playing at home or on the road. It's not like that anymore.
Aaron Portsline covers the Blue Jackets for the Columbus Dispatch. Portsline says that last year's success notwithstanding, the biggest news for the team came this past summer when Nash, who's averaged 35 goals over the last five seasons, signed an 8-year Mega Million Dollar contract extension.
That a real elite NHL talent like Rick Nash would choose to stay in Columbus, I think it really elevated the Blue Jackets' reputation, and it's caused other players, I think, to look at Columbus in a different light. You've seen very young, talented players sign on long-term, and they all acknowledge that the extension signed by Rick Nash makes this a place that they want to stay.
The team's rising stars, including 21-year-old goalie Steve Mason, who won the Calder Trophy as the league's top rookie last year, are barely out of their teens, rendering the 25-year-old Nash a veritable graybeard. Hitchcock says that this year Nash has emerged as a more forceful team leader.
He's a pretty outspoken guy now, you know, like if things aren't going well or the team isn't playing the right way, he's either speaking up on the bench or he's speaking up in the locker room. That's a big change.
What's also helped are the lessons from last season's playoff encounter with Detroit. Nash says that while he and his teammates had their helmets handed to them, they also got an up-close tutorial on how to step it up a notch in the postseason. The Blue Jackets streaked to five wins in their first six games this season and are vying with Detroit and Chicago for first place in the NHL Central Division.
The Columbus goal is his 11th goal of the season, scored by number 61, Rick Nash.
Last Saturday night, after trailing the Carolina Hurricanes for most of the game, the Blue Jackets scored three goals in the first 3.5 minutes of the final period. Nash, who'd been treated roughly by as many as four defenders every time he approached their net, scored what proved to be the game winner. Dave DeLauder has been a season ticket holder since the Blue Jackets first took to the ice in 2000. He likes what he's seen more recently.
They've done it the right way. They brought in a lot of young talent, and they're trying to develop that young talent. And I think over this year, the next couple, you'll see that that's going to pay off for the Jackets. I think we're setting ourselves up just like the Detroit franchise of the old days. They had a lot of young players, stayed with them a long time. I think the Jackets are going to be in that mold for the next decade.
In this town, though, the Blue Jackets' most formidable competitor doesn't even play in the NHL. Blue Jackets GM Scott Housen admits that hockey night in Columbus can't trump game day for Ohio State University football.
They're in a league by themselves right now, and we're still fighting for our space. And more people are starting to care about hockey and to believe that we can put a winning product on the ice. And the way we get more recognition and more space and more notoriety is to win.
Longtime fan DeLauder is also a big Ohio State supporter, and was hard-pressed to turn off the Penn State game to join the almost 15,000 here tonight. But he does offer this consolation.
You got to remember, Ohio State rules the football season in Columbus, and then we get a nice long break until New Year's Day when we go play in a bowl game. You'll see the attendance for the Blue Jackets pick up right after we beat Michigan at the end of November.
After which, the Blue Jackets will have Columbus sports fans all to themselves. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.org. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website, onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Does this song sound familiar? Well, it should. If you watched the 2007 Major League Baseball playoffs, you probably heard Jon Bon Jovi singing I Love This Town in the background of baseball promos on TBS. Samuel Bartley Steele heard it too and felt Mr. Bon Jovi's rendition was just a little too close to his song, Man, I Really Love This Team. Though a judge saw no substantial similarities between the two songs, Mr. Steele is continuing his lawsuit against Bon Jovi, Time Warner, and Major League Baseball. What compensation does Mr. Steele hope to receive for the alleged theft of his musical masterpiece? $400 billion. That's with a B. I'm Karen Given in for Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, you can call him Chad, you can call him Ocho Cinco, but don't call him Mr. Johnson. Only he can do that. But first, I'm joined by Yahoo Sports columnist Dan Wetzel to discuss Week 10 of the NFL season. Dan, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Karen. Good to be on.
Chicago quarterback Jay Cutler became the league's leading thrower on Thursday, of interceptions, that is. He threw five during Thursday's game against San Francisco and has thrown a whopping 17 interceptions in 9 games. Do you think the Bears regret giving Cutler that $20 million contract extension last month?
Well, I think that there's certainly going to be some debate inside the franchise whether Jay Cutler is as good as they hoped. At the same time, he makes plays that can win you games. He's a very daring player, and that blows up on him. Now, the player they basically got rid of for him and sent to Denver, Kyle Orton, had a tremendous start to the season, but has now kind of slowed down his play as the Broncos have dropped a couple games. And the real question is, you know, is Cutler more likely guy that can get you to a Super Bowl than Kyle Orton? That's probably true, but it is not going to be smooth sailing along the way.
New Orleans is the NFC's only undefeated team at 8-0. Where's the magic coming from?
Offensively, this is a terrific team. You know, I would like to remind the Only a Game audience that I did pick the Saints to make the Super Bowl. Preseason.
Noted.
My one pick that seems to be looking good. They got a great offense. Drew Brees, Reggie Bush, the passing game's all over. They're throwing around the dome. And if they can get home field advantage, which, you know, they're on the fast track to do, they can play their games inside a very loud Superdome down in New Orleans, and it'll be very good for that club. But it's really all offense.
Well, the Saints play 1-7 St. Louis tomorrow. I hope we don't see any Saint-on-Saint violence. I can't believe I said it.
There will be some Saint-on-Saint violence, and it will not be good for the Louis Saints. They will not do too well. Yeah, this is going to be a real barn burner. I would expect 9-0, and it's one of the weird parts of the NFL season this year is the league's mantra through the years has been on any given Sunday and parity and anything can happen. This year, anything can't happen. There are a number of excellent teams, such as the Saints, the Vikings, the undefeated Colts, great football teams, and there are some terrible teams, and the St. Louis Rams are one of them.
New England will be in Indianapolis tomorrow night. The compliments flying back and forth between quarterbacks Tom Brady and Peyton Manning have been almost as breathtaking as their passes usually are. Is this one of the NFL's greatest head-to-head player rivalries?
The whole thing with the Colts and the Patriots has been one of the best rivalries of this decade and one of the best things that happened to the NFL this decade. And it's funny because at this point, it seems like the bad blood that was there for a while in the middle of the decade has kind of gone away, at least in the press conference talks. This time, everyone's holding hands and telling each other how beautiful they are. I think it'll still be a serious game, though, when they get out in the field. Big game for the Patriots because they need to kind of reassert themselves in the race for AFC home field advantage.
So who wins?
I think the Colts win. The Patriots are playing a lot better, but they've been racking it up against some of the easier teams in the league, and I think the Colts are a little bit more legit. They have a tremendous defense of all things. Peyton Manning may throw for more yards than anybody, but this team's winning with defense. Only allowed 108 points, which is best in the league. So I'll take the Colts in that one.
Cowboys quarterback Tony Romo is 13-0 in the month of November, but he can't like that moniker any more than Alex Rodriguez liked being called Mr. July, right?
Tony Romo is 13-0 in November, and he's 5-8 in December.
Ouch.
He's not any better in January. The Cowboys have had some tremendous regular seasons and put up some great performances under Tony Romo the last few years. They still have not won a playoff game since the mid-1990s. So really, even in Dallas, where people are always excited about football, but very excited about not just the way this team's playing, but the way they're playing together. A lot of excitement in Dallas, but at the same time, everyone's saying, let's see it in December, and more importantly, let's see it in January, particularly from Romo, who's prone to some just disastrous big games.
Cincinnati will be in Pittsburgh for a very important game that will establish, at least temporarily, AFC North supremacy. Will Chad Ochocinco be able to help the Bengals 86, that's 86, the Steelers?
You got some good ones today. Yes, huge game for the Bengals because they are 6-2. They did defeat Pittsburgh earlier this season, but they are still the Bengals/Bungles. And you just don't quite believe that this is the club that can beat out the Steelers. So this is going to be a monster game. And Chad Ochocinco would have a great deal to prove because, as he's shown through the years, a terrific wide receiver at times, but he's never played for the big winner. And all the antics and all that stuff overshadows a lot. And the best way for him to get fame is to win.
Dan Wetzel is a columnist for Yahoo Sports, and he joins us from time to time to discuss pro and college football. Thanks, Dan.
Hey, thank you. Take care.
During last Sunday's game between Cincinnati and Baltimore, the aforementioned Bengals wide receiver Chad Ochocinco bummed a buck off an assistant and pretended to bribe a referee. For his single-dollar half-hearted bribe attempt, the NFL will fine him $20,000. Those who are familiar with Ocho Cinco's antics aren't surprised by all of this. This is the guy who has proposed to a cheerleader, danced the river dance, and performed CPR on a football to celebrate touchdowns. Those celebrations, as well as his decision to legally change his name, are all chronicled in his new book, Ocho Cinco, What Football and Life Have Thrown My Way. Joining me now from NPR's New York Bureau is Chad Ocho Cinco, formerly Chad Johnson, or maybe he's just Ocho Cinco, drop the Chad. Regardless, welcome to Only a Game.
How you doing? How's everybody?
We're great, thank you. Let's start there. What should I call you? Chad, Mr. Ocho Cinco?
You know what? You can call me Chad. That's my first name. You know, you usually don't go around calling people by their last names anyway. You know, the last name change was basically for football, and it was all marketing reasons.
Well, when you decided to legally change your name to force the NFL to let you wear Ocho Cinco on the back of your jersey, my coworkers and I all thought it was a great joke, but we didn't think you were going to go through with it.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. You know, it's something different, you know. I mean, what do you expect from somebody like myself who has fun playing the game and really changing, you know, the position, you know, at wide receiver in my own way? Everybody loves it. I mean, how could you not? How could you not love me and what I've done for the game as far as having fun and making it exciting? You know, whether you're a fan of the Bengals or not, you know, I'm sure you're a fan of Ocho.
Well, I want to go back a bit in the Ocho Cinco story. You were raised by your grandmother in Liberty City in Miami. She made sure that you went to school and played sports in better neighborhoods. But now that you can move her out, she chooses to stay.
Man, she won't budge. I don't understand. And she's grounded where she's at. She likes where she is. She's been there for years. And, you know, I've told her numerous times, you know, baby girl, it's time for change. And she says, no, you know, I've been here for years. I have memories, you know, on the street in this house. And I think that's where it goes from there. And I've tried, but, you know, she loves it. I mean, you know, I'm from Liberty City, you know, which is a rough area in Miami-Dade County. Fortunately, I was able to make it out the area and do things the right way, you know, through her guidance and her help and actually not having her give up on me. You know, I wasn't the best of kids growing up, but, you know, I made the most of my opportunities and I took advantage of them.
Your grandmother was a teacher and school was very important to her, but it wasn't important to you.
Oh, no. It's so funny. It's usually when you're the child of someone that is, you know, has something to do with being strict or teacher or a police officer, it seems that their kids are always the one that never behave themselves, you know, and that's how I was in school. She always had to come to my school for me being in trouble, for skipping class, walking in the hallways without a hall pass, just, you know, things of that nature. And it's funny, you would think with her being a teacher that I would be, you know, the perfect little angel, and I was the complete opposite. And, you know, I drove her crazy, man, growing up. And so one of the things that, you know, I wanted to do once I made it was give back and just thank her for everything she did for me. But, you know, she doesn't want it. I think just her knowing that I'm there for her if she needed me, you know, is enough for her.
Now, you say in this book that if you hadn't been good at football, you probably would have become a drug dealer in the old neighborhood. But you also say that if you could take all your friends and move them to Planet Chad, there would be no drugs there. Explain this to me.
No. You have to think. Where I'm from, where I grew up, I mean, there's sports, and then there's the street life. There's no in-between. There is no in-between. It's not like we had things we can get ourselves into. I mean, this is real life, you know, I'm talking about. It's not a joke. And for me to be able to provide for my family, provide for my mom, I'm trying to think, what are some of the things that I would be able to do? Because I was not a whiz when it came to the books, you know? And part of that, of me telling you that in that book is, you know, I fought against the odds. I didn't want to go that route. I didn't want to have to be like some of my friends, you know, that are locked up. You know, some of them are dead. And so I made it, you know, and I'm just saying, if I hadn't have made it, the only thing I could think of, because that's all I knew at the time, you know, was to go that route. And it didn't end up that way.
You've caught for at least 1,000 yards in 6 consecutive NFL seasons. You've been to 5 straight Pro Bowls, but you're probably best known for your touchdown celebrations. Do you have a favorite?
No, the favorite hasn't come yet. Actually, I have one that I've thought, it's very fun that you said that. I have one in mind. It has a Spanish theme to it due to the name change, and it's going to be a classic. It's going to be one of the best that I've ever done. I'm probably going to get in trouble for it, but who cares? I'm thinking of doing it, you know, in the next 3 weeks. So This is going to be really cool.
The NFL fines you for your celebrations, but you say they also profit by using video of them to promote their games. And I read enough of your book to know that you're no dummy with your money. So do you think the attention you get for your celebrations outweighs the NFL fines?
In a way. I mean, it's you know, I think the attention I get for having fun, you know, for having fun is scrutinized. They blow it out of proportion. They claim the money goes for good cause. So I think it's no problem. I'm just having fun. They don't like it. You know, anytime you have any type of personality, anytime you step outside the box and you don't do things the way they think you should or the way they want you to do them, you know, they create a problem.
You devote an entire chapter of this book to trash talk, and at least the players who were interviewed seem to enjoy the banter. But did I read this right? Do you actually research your trash talk?
Yeah, you got it. You have to know what you're talking about before you do it. I need to know everything about my opponent, you know, on and off the field. I need to know any little things that I can use on the field to get to them, you know, to help me out or give me that advantage. And once I get in the head, man, it's pretty much a done deal.
But we should point out there are places in trash talk you just don't go, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, in any profession, there are certain lines that you don't cross, and I don't cross lines of becoming disrespectful in any way, you know, in any way. So, man, I know where to draw the line.
You mentioned Muhammad Ali quite a few times in this book, and it's clear that you admire him. Ali certainly was known for trash talk in his younger days, but as he got older, he used his celebrity to promote peace. Have you ever considered promoting something other than Ocho Cinco?
Well, really, you know, anytime I open my mouth, I'm promoting the Cincinnati Bengals. And anytime I walk out or anytime I open my mouth, I'm representing them at all times. So, I mean, that's enough right there.
You've mentioned quite a few careers you'd like to try out. Boxing, acting, sports reporting for OCNN.
Oh, yeah.
That's the Ocho Cinco News Network. What will Ocho Cinco be doing when football is over?
Man, who knows? Who knows? The doors are opening up all over the place, man. God is continuing to bless me. I'm doing everything the right way. But OCNN is basically a one-man social network, which, you know, with that being me, that I'm basically just beating everybody to the punch. You know, I'm beating radio, I'm beating newscasters, I'm beating ESPN, I'm beating all these Goliath stations. Yeah, it's going to be fun.
Chad Ocho Cinco's new biography called Ocho Cinco, What Football and Life Have Thrown My Way, is published by Crown. He joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Chad, thanks for joining me.
No, thank you. I appreciate it.
To visit Only a Game's magical web world, please go to onlyagame.org. You're listening to Only a Game. The revelations in Open, Andre Agassi's biography, have been circulating for weeks. The winner of 8 Grand Slams and an Olympic gold medal hated tennis. He wore a hairpiece. He used crystal meth. When Agassi appeared on CBS's 60 Minutes on Sunday, that last confession was still on the mind of Katie Couric.
How many times did you do crystal meth, you think?
You know, it was a foggy time in my life for a lot of reasons. The simple answer is I don't know. I did it way too many.
About?
By the time he appeared on NPR's Fresh Air 3 days later, Agassi had plenty to say to those, including tennis great Martina Navratilova, who have criticized him for lying to officials after he tested positive for the drug. Far from being a performance enhancer, Agassi says, crystal meth was a performance inhibitor, and he hopes sports can find a more helpful way to deal with positive tests for recreational drugs.
Instead of judgments or condemnation, that there should be some compassion towards the possibility that this person really has a problem and needs help. And I think that always should be considered because I lived it and I needed help.
Agassi's drug use came at a time when he had fallen to 141st in the world. But according to his book, his troubles started long before that, when his father pushed him to play tennis as a young child. He turned pro at 16 to escape a Florida tennis camp that he hated, only to find himself even more unhappy on the tennis tour. Boston Globe and Tennis Channel commentator Bud Collins says Agassi's angst was evident.
He was very difficult when I first encountered him on the Pro Tour. He seemed arrogant. I think he was often wanted to lose, to say something to his father. It's a story that goes from the bottom, from the dumps, to the top, where he is now.
Collins disagrees with Martina Navratilova's assertion that Agassi proved himself to be as bad as Roger Clemens when he lied to the ATP about how he ingested crystal meth.
Some people have been very harsh. You know, they've said it's a blot on the game. I don't think it's a blot on the game. It was a momentary blot on Andre, and he's confessed. And I'm so glad he found his way, because we all benefited from watching the tennis that he gave us. I look forward to the day at Newport, Rhode Island, when he's inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame. Now, I'm sure that there'll be objections to that. Some people will hold that against him forever, of course, but I don't.
He's got your vote.
He's got my vote right now, and I'm on the nominating committee.
Andre Agassi will be eligible for the International Hall of Fame in 2011. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Soldiers Project works outside the military to treat soldiers trying to cope with the stress of duty, and the families who have their own challenge and trauma. The parent of a soldier says,
"It's so much emotional pain. As a parent, you almost have your own PTSD to deal with."
Our Impact of War project continues. I'm Scott Simon. Join us Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Japanese lingerie designer Triumph is known for novelty bras. First, there was the chopstick bra, made from miso soup and rice bowls. Don't ask me how that one works. And now there's the good shot bra. The dubious support garment features a corset-like top, which, when removed, unrolls into a 5-foot indoor putting mat, with the cups simulating, well, cups. It's sold as a set with a stylish pink wraparound skirt, which can be removed and used as a flag asking spectators to be quiet. Should a putt be sunk by our now braless and skirtless golf aficionado, speakers in the cups will announce, "Nice shot," to celebrate her efforts. It was good. I'm Karen Given, filling in for Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, the Indonesian sport that elevates some 12-year-old boys to hero status. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Bill. Oh, God. I knew that was coming. I knew it. I walked in here knowing it was going to happen. Hi, Karen.
The NBA season is still young, but we already have our first coaching casualty. The New Orleans Hornets fired Byron Scott on Thursday. Is a 3-6 start a good reason to give the boot to the 2008 Coach of the Year?
No, but we have to understand that the Hornets are owned by a very, one would say unhinged if one were unkind, man named George Shin. And 3-6 this year apparently trumps 56-26 last year. I have a feeling we are going to discover as the weeks go by that there's some sort of player revolt behind this, because otherwise it just doesn't make any sense.
On the other end of the spectrum, the Boston Celtics started their season 8-1 for the second time in 3 years, Charlie, with some help from a guy I like to call Mr. Excitement. Your cover story on Rajon Rondo runs in Boston Globe magazine this weekend. Is Rondo worthy of his new $55 million contract?
I think there's no question that he is. He is no worse than one of the five best point guards in the league right now. But more to the point for the Boston Celtics, he's the best point guard they have, which is very important given the nature of the team, the way the team is constructed. This is a genuinely scarily good basketball team right now. And the only thing that obviously can come a cropper is the fact that they are fairly old and the injuries may pile up.
Speaking of people good at playing basketball, LeBron James suggested this week that his number should be retired. What's that all about?
Well, he's not his number per se. As he thinks Michael Jordan's number should be retired by all the teams in the league. The interesting thing, of course, is that he wants Jordan's number retired by every team in the NBA because of Michael's performance as a player and the championships he won. LeBron's alternative is to take upon himself the number 6. Now, those of us whose memories go back longer than what we had for dinner 3 days ago will point out that that's Bill Russell's number, who won 11 championships.
Two teams remain undefeated in the 10th week of the NFL season, New Orleans and Indianapolis. Who's more likely to fall tomorrow?
I suspect probably Indianapolis, since New Orleans is going to St. Louis to play what's left of the St. Louis Rams. Of course, tomorrow night we get the annual Tom Brady, Peyton Manning drama extravaganza in Indianapolis. I think New England's got a much better chance of beating Indianapolis than St. Louis has of beating New Orleans.
Cleveland Browns running back Jamal Lewis says coach Eric Mangini is working his young players too hard. I have no idea if that's true, but it can't be good when your players start referring to themselves as agricultural goods.
Yeah,
can it?
Yeah. Jamal Lewis, who has had his own problems with agricultural products, as we know, and has already announced his retirement, by the way, has decided that Eric Mangini is not rotating the soil enough. He says, you got to take care of your crop. If you don't, when it comes time to harvest, you're not going to make no money because the crop is no good. That's that. Well, that certainly is that, actually. But if I were Jamal Lewis, I wouldn't be talking about any kind of crop anytime soon.
Green Bay's Aaron Kampman and Arizona's Sean Morey both played with concussions last Sunday. Morey made news earlier this year when he announced that he would donate his brain and spinal cord for study. Do you find it alarming that a player who knows the dangers of playing with head injuries was able to convince himself to play with a concussion?
I've long ago given up trying to figure out how professional football players determine their own mortality. There's no excuse now for playing with a concussion. Everybody knows what the symptoms are. Everybody knows what the consequences are. Good on Sean Morey, by the way, for making that arrangement to donate his brain and his spinal column after he's dead. The problem is the culture of the game is such that you can't fight it, even with medical science.
I'm all for NFL players supporting the Gridiron Greats Assistance Fund for retired players, Charlie. But there's got to be a better way than Eagles tight end Brent Celek advertising rum in the end zone, yes?
He apparently posed in the end zone in imitation of the Captain Morgan rum label. And I saw him like lift his leg up and do that. I couldn't figure out what he was doing, so it's nice to have an answer on that.
According to the internet rumor mill, the NFL has chosen the halftime entertainment for February's Super Bowl. So who is it?
Exactly. Unfortunately, that's a pun that grew old in 1965.
Aww.
And equally unfortunate to those of us who have been uncompromising fans of this band since 1965, it is going to be what we have come to call the Daltrey Townsend Band, which is performing under the name of The Who.
You and Bill recently talked about PGA golfer Doug Barron and his unexpected positive test for banned drugs. This week, he sued for an injunction to allow him to play in next week's PGA qualifying tournament. Should the PGA have allowed things to get to this point in the first place?
Well, I don't know what information he provided to the PGA Tour about his medical conditions. Barron has been taking beta blockers, which is one of the things they caught him on, for a heart condition for 22 years, and he's been taking testosterone shots since 2005. They're both prescribed by doctors. Unless the court will rule that he had an obligation to inform the PGA prior to the test on this and therefore will not grant the injunction, I think he's got a pretty good case.
Jim Riggleman, interim manager of the Washington Nationals, is now Jim Riggleman, manager of the Washington Nationals. Under Riggleman's lead, the Nats performed significantly better than they had under Manny Acta, who was fired in July. Can the Nats maybe possibly get out of last place next year?
Well, I mean, Riggleman brought them all the way from a .299 winning percentage to a .440 winning percentage. They were merely 9 games under .500 under him. I like the fact that he's now being referred to as the permanent manager of the Washington Nationals as though there were any such thing.
The St. Louis Cardinals are apparently having trouble figuring out how to best present Mark McGwire, their new batting coach, to fans and the media. Do you have any suggestions?
Yes, hypnosis. Mass hypnosis. You will forget everything that's happened in the last 10 years. There's no way. It's going to be a circus. They had to know this going in. They're obviously developing strategies, none of which will work. And every time the St. Louis Cardinals go to a new town this year during the baseball season, the same questions are going to come up over and over again.
Meanwhile, lawyers for Roger Clemens are seeking to dismiss a defamation suit brought by former trainer Brian McNamee by arguing that when Clemens and others questioned McNamee's mental state and accused him of manufacturing evidence, they, quote, weren't serious. Is this kind of like when you were a kid and you claimed lying doesn't count if you're crossing your fingers behind your back?
I don't know what that is unless they've gotten a look at what was coming in discovery and want to get out of court as fast as they humanly can. I think that when you make a statement to a court, that's serious. Courts are not known for their senses of humor.
Good news, Charlie.
Oh.
After 2 years of court battles, at least 3 proposed venues, and 18 teams left on dry land, sailing teams Alinghi and BMW Oracle have finally agreed on the location and timing of the next America's Cup. But does anyone care?
I'm not exactly sure. I didn't know all this legal beagling was going on around it. The America's Cup has certainly fallen off my radar.
And finally, Charlie, walking into Yankees Stadium wearing a Mets jacket can be dangerous all on its own. But for danger seekers everywhere, the U.S. Marshals Service is offering up an item at auction today that can take that excitement to the next level. Could you please tell me what the item is?
It had to be the Mets, right? This guy could not have been a Red Sox fan, right? It had to be the Mets. It's Bernie Madoff's Mets jacket with the name Madoff on the back. Now, after about 93 beers, the average Mets fan is going to see that, not realize or not remember that Bernie Madoff is in the federal sneezer until we colonize Mars. So anybody who wears this should arrange to have a nice big bullseye stitched into the back of it, too.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe Sunday magazine and joins Bill Littlefield each week at this time on Only a Game. Charlie, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Karen.
Antoinette, dainty queen with her quaint guillotine, yeah. Those were the good old days.
For centuries, rice farmers on the Indonesian island of Madura have gathered each harvest season to race bulls. The contests are an annual rite of passage for the jockeys, young boys out to prove their toughness. Now the hardscrabble island hopes to make the Karapan Sapi bull races an international tourist attraction. Chad Bouchard has our story.
Early in the morning at the edge of a dusty field, 2 teams of bulls strut past each other in a procession. Each pair is followed by a troop of musicians. The rival horn and drum players try to drown each other out. It's a kind of musical trash talk. The bulls are dressed up in their finest headdresses made of colorful cloth and studded with gems, but the jockeys walking behind them are just ragged children, boys eager to prove their courage. 12-year-old Asianto, the most feared jockey at today's races, is wearing a dirty red t-shirt, grease-stained shorts, and no shoes. As his team gets settled into place at the starting line, he wraps his feet in rags for protection. With a wave of the starter's red flag, the animals thunder down the 200-meter dirt track. Asianto stands on a flimsy wood sled, using the bulls' tails for reins. The bulls can reach speeds of 45 miles an hour. The race is over just 12 seconds later. Asianto has won again. It takes months to prepare a bull for those crucial seconds. During the race season, which lasts from August to October, the bulls are force-fed 50 eggs every day, washed down with a concoction of ginger, coffee, rice wine, and medicinal herbs. They even get a daily massage. Asianto and the other riders sleep in the stables next to their bulls. 30-year-old Harianto is a former jockey who now works on one of the race teams.
To make the jockeys closer to the bulls, they become like guardians. Later, if the bulls are injured, the jockeys will be more sympathetic. That way, the bulls are less likely to hurt the jockeys.
On race day, the bovine spa treatments come to an abrupt end. Instead, the bulls' backsides are lashed until they're bloody. Team members then smear stinging camphor ointment on their wounds and even on their genitals. By the time they leap across the starting line, the bulls are angry, in pain, and hardly controllable by a small boy hanging onto their tails. Fairly or unfairly, the Madhuris are known for being hot-headed, with crass manners, loud voices, and a tendency to brandish machetes during arguments. Like much of Indonesia, the Madhuris converted to Islam around the 1300s, but the race tradition is steeped in older Hindu and animist beliefs. An owner of one of the bull teams, Rofian Adaraja, says the explosive style of the bull race matches the Madhuri's spirit.
Yeah, maybe we're loud like that. I mean, there are all types. But in fact, the bull race was once a harvest festival. That's what it was really for. The Madhuris are brave.
On the sidelines of the Karapan Sapi bull races, a man shaves ice from a block to serve up as a cooling snack to spectators. Bull racing started out as a harvest time activity, a celebration to mark the transition from a long, brutally hot dry season to the torrential downpours of rainy season. It's still mostly a local event, but tourists do show up now and then. Dave Worthington from New Jersey came over from neighboring Java Island, where he works, to see today's races. He soon found himself surrounded by a crowd of Madhuris wanting to take their picture with him and practice their English.
I feel like I've never seen anything like this, and I also feel like most of the people here have never seen Americans. I feel like I play for the New England Patriots.
There may not be a lot of outsiders here yet, but the racing community has begun to sense the tourism potential. They started doing some of those little things guests appreciate, like taking people's machetes away to prevent bloodshed. 70-year-old race fan Adarofo says even 5 years ago, armed brawls between the teams broke out regularly.
Yeah, the threats have gone down now. It's more peaceful. There used to be machete fights every time. Now it's calm. There's more awareness.
Now the worst thing spectators have to worry about is getting trampled by a bull. At one point on race day, as the crowd watches yet another heat, a team of bulls takes a 90-degree turn out of the starting gate and charges straight into the crowd. Spectators scatter as they break through the fence, just missing one of the onlookers, Sukardi.
They ran from over there, crashed straight through here, and came out here, just crashed. And a kid, the jockey, was taken to the hospital. Everyone else ran out of the way.
Blazing heat and choking clouds of dust also present a challenge to the casual fan. Still, there's a charm to the rawness and chaos of it all. Team owner Haji Mosale is convinced Americans could love this sport. In fact, he's named his racing team Obama in hopes of luring the number one American here.
Actually, I like Obama, and I'd like Obama to become a supporter. Maybe this way Americans could become more familiar with the race and come here. It would be great for Americans to become big supporters of this tradition.
Back at the stable, 12-year-old jockey Azianto tends to his thirsty team with a water bottle. It's the last race of the day, and the boy has his game face on. He says his reputation is on the line.
Makes me happy to race the bulls, because a lot of people see the competition. I'm famous in school.
But Azianto will have to wait a while because the animals are clearly worn out, and one of them decides to go on strike at the starting line. Each time the bulls are put in position, he lies down flat. It takes a crew of 12 to get him back into place. Their opponents are grappling with the same problem. It takes a full hour to get all four animals lined up and the two jockeys poised on the sleds. The midday sun is brutal. A nearby mosque peals out the call to prayer, the local equivalent of a clock tower striking high noon in a spaghetti western. Finally, a race official waves the red flag. The final race is declared a tie, but it doesn't matter because the top four teams get a ticket to race in the winner-takes-all event the following week. In the winner's circle in front of the spectator tent, Asianto's face beams as he hefts a giant trophy. For all that trouble, he also gets to take home a refrigerator.
Yeah, I'm happy, because I got one of the top places. I won every race.
As the winners march out of the stadium and parade into town, Asianto clearly enjoys his moment of glory. Racing bulls may be a declaration of manhood, but for the first time today, he looks like a kid. For Only a Game, I'm Chad Bouchard.
Only a Game is produced by Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Jeremy Bernfeld. We had help this week from Jim Kiesling, Glenn Alexander, Michael Garth, Mike Toda, Peter Laidotis, George Hicks, and Jonathan Peck. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Chad Bouchard's Bull Racing Photo Gallery, download our weekly podcast, learn more about the music you hear on our program, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from Cincinnati Bengals wide receiver Chad Ochocinco, who gets a lot of late-night football ideas. So he has the following warning for his current and future coaches.
I will wake you up 2, 3, 4 in the morning. It doesn't matter what time it is.
I don't know why NFL coaches would care. Most of them are drawing up plays at those hours anyway. I'm Karen Gibbon. Bill Littlefield returns next week. Thanks for listening.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.